Welcome to the Orlando North Church Podcast. Through this podcast, we hope you'll be both encouraged and challenged as you hear what God is speaking to you. Orlando North is called to go and be Christ's church to the world through the Holy Spirit by connecting people to God and to each other for His glory. More details about our church will be available at the end of this podcast. Now, enjoy this week's episode.
This morning, we're going to dive in. We're going to talk about the gap, week five of the gap, week five of six. And here's what we're doing in this series. We're talking about this space, this gap between promise and fulfillment. From where God gives us a promise, something that is going to happen, and then the fulfillment of the promise is this gap. For some seasons of our life, the gap is short and relatively easy. For others, it's relatively long and painful and all this. So we want to talk about this, and we offered it up, as the British do, with mind the gap, pay attention to the gap, because it's really, really important what happens between this space, between promise and fulfillment. What's going on there? And we've been looking at it through the eyes of David, or through the story of King David, or David prior to King David. And we've been looking at the early years of David's life, where he was anointed and called to be king as a 14, 15-year-old boy, and then he didn't become king for another 15, 16 years later when he was a 30-year-old man. Okay, so we see this gap of 15, 16 years where David has all this margin, all this space, all this room to work with. And we're looking at it, and there's good times, there's bad times. It's kind of all over the place. Last week it was tough. Last week was David's fall and kind of some things that he made some really poor choices on. But for the most part, it's good and it's bad. Now, my question is, as we start off today, do you wish in the gap that it was always easy? That space in the gap, don't you wish it was like beaches and Mai Tais, for all you Baptists and Pentecostals, non-alcoholic Mai Tais, all right? So so we're talking about that, and it would be really nice if everything was smooth and painless. Relationships were nice, relationships were easy, relationships weren't messy, but we know that the gap's not like that at all, that the gap can be a pretty turbulent season. What do we do with the turbulence in our lives? Now, I know this is going to shock you, but last week I was thinking about food. Anybody else? Anybody else, when you're daydreaming, it's just like food? Nope, just me? Okay, so it's food. Some of you guys, right now, you're thinking about food because I put it in your brain. So I think about food and I think about sports. Sometimes I think about naps. And so I think about food a lot. And it got triggered because Pastor Will, our youth pastor, and Jonathan, our guitar player, the one that's back here in the corner, a couple weeks ago, they went out and they went to a Brazilian steakhouse. And apparently, it was a Brazilian steakhouse that is like a notch or two above Texas Day Brazil. So how many of you guys have been to Texas Day Brazil before? How many of you guys are still feeling it? You're like still feeling that meal that you ate. Brazilian steakhouses is just a carnivore's delight. It's just all meat. They have a salad bar, but why waste your time there, right? And it's a vegetarian's nightmare. It's like, no, I mean, it's a carnivore's delight. So Will and Jonathan went to this restaurant. Circumstances worked out where they went, and it was really expensive, ridiculously expensive, but they ate and they ate and they ate. They came back and they told me about it. And I salivated, and it was delicious. I didn't even eat there, and it was delicious. Tenderloin, medium rare, wrapped in bacon. Come on, man. You can't beat that. And the amount of salt that they put on it, and then you got the house sirloin, you've got pork tenderloin, you've got all these meats. And if you've never been to a Brazilian steakhouse, the way it happens is they've got this card that's either green or red. When it's green, they're going to just keep bringing meat to you, to your table. They're going to slice it fresh off a skewer to you. And when you're done, you put it on red, and they will still bring meat to you. They'll just make sure, hey, you sure you don't want any more meat? You're like, no, I'm good. I put on 25 pounds. I'm good. And so they're telling me about this, and I'm like, oh, it sounds so delicious and so expensive at the same time. And here's how my brain works. You ready for this? Because you're not, if I gave you a million guesses on where I transitioned from with that, you would never guess it. I went from thinking about a Brazilian steakhouse to Prince Harry and Prince William. Anybody else go there? Here's my thought. Prince Harry and Prince William eat meals like that. They have at their beck and call at all times, meals like that. Do you think Prince Harry and Prince William ever had a bologna sandwich? Or Totino's, like Hot Pockets? Macaroni and cheese, Kraft macaroni and cheese, not the real kind. Well, that is, how many of you guys like Kraft macaroni and cheese better than the real kind, right? Yeah, me too. I love the powder. The powder, eat that powder. So, but I was thinking, I wonder if Harry and William, and this last summer, we actually saw Harry drive by in a car. I should have asked him, hey, you ever had a bologna sandwich? And like seriously, because think about their meals. They've grown up in Buckingham Palace. or Kensington Palace, which one of the palaces. They've grown up in London, and they have their own personal chefs, and so from the day that they were born, everything was made to order. It's like, hey, you want a burger? Let's go to Wendy's. No. You want a burger? Let's call Chef Raphael. Or that's not good. You need an American name for burger. Let's call Chef Larry. And Larry will come in, and he's got the Kobe beef and fresh vegetables. Fancy, well, there's not fancy ketchup. Can we just all agree Heinz has a monopoly and anything else is disgusting, okay? So, and you catsup lovers, what? I don't get it. And maybe some Grey Poupon, but of course, okay? So they've got this to order. They've got all this stuff to order. And I was wondering, do they ever have the contrast of bologna? Like for us, that five-star meal or that meal that Will and Jonathan had was delicious and amazing and made me salivate because it's not the huge, it's not the norm. Right? I'm not eating their breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's just, okay, for the most part, I've had bologna and sometimes some spaghetti and some powdered Kraft macaroni and cheese. But when, man, I get that Texas Day Brazil, that's a big deal. And I wonder if Harry and William have ever had that because it's always been good for them. Now, here's the... preachers can twist anything, okay? So here it is. Here it is. I wonder if in our lives, in the gap, if those seasons that are really rough set up for us those moments of reprieve so that they feel even better, right? We've talked about contrast before, where the moments where things are at ease and things are okay, we really delight in those and we really saturate and enjoy those because for the most part, it's not always like that. For the most part, it's Tutino's pizza and it's macaroni and cheese and it's peanut butter and jelly and it's bologna and oh, sometimes it's starvation. And when we get that steak, that moment, all of a sudden that steak tastes complete. I bet you our steak tastes better than William and Harry's. I bet you we enjoy it a little bit more than they do because they have it all the time. Now, you're going, this is a weird message. If you're telling me, give me good, bad times all the time so when I have a good time. It's not necessarily what I'm saying. I'm saying in the gap, do enjoy those seasons where things are good because it's not always that way. How many of you guys know that vacation feels really good when you've worked really hard? You ever gone on vacation when you've been a lazy employee for a year? It's still good, but it's not as good, right? But when you've worked really hard, you've had a really rough year, it really is good. How about traffic in Orlando? On Sunday mornings, Sundays are my favorite because I get here, Chase and I get here between 6:30 and 7. There's no traffic. It's awesome. But Monday through Friday, I hate I-4. I live a mile and a half from work and it takes me 20 minutes. Come on, man. Right? So there's this contrast, there's this difference between the two. Victories taste better when your team has lost forever and ever. How many... In here, you're like, your teams have been notorious losers. And when you finally win, it's like, that's really good. Friendships in contrast to stressful relationships, all of these things are different. The truth is, in the gap, there's going to be a lot of struggle and there's going to be a lot of pain, but there's also going to be reprieve. There's going to be moments when things are right and things are good and things are okay. And in those moments, what is God doing? This is what David is up to. Last week, what we've seen so far in David's life up to this point in the gap, things started out okay. Samuel comes and anoints him as king. That's a good day, right? Really good day. But then his brothers are like, nah, not so much. You're still my little brother. We still don't believe that this is true. So David couldn't even enjoy his day because his brothers are still looking down on him. Then he kills Goliath. That's a great day. Like all of a sudden, you go from the background to the forefront. Everybody's like, you're the national hero. Way to go, David. You can do anything. It's an awesome day. Goes to David's head, maybe just a little bit, but out of fear, isolation, and anger, David makes a really bad decision because Saul is jealous of David. Saul doesn't like that David's getting all the attention. And so David makes a bad decision, takes matters into his own hands. And as we saw last week, a number of people, not just a number, hundreds of people got murdered because of a decision that David made where he took things into his own hands. Turbulent, bumpy, really hard. Today is the rebound day. Today is the day where David makes some good decisions, and because of everything he's been through, I would imagine this point in the gap feels a little bit differently. He makes better decisions, he thinks a little bit more, he trusts God more, and I think it probably feels a little bit different. Now, here's what American culture is teaching you, that our purpose in the gap, when it's turbulent and bumpy, our purpose in the gap is to make that turbulence go away. That's our purpose. Like if things are rough, if things are bad, if we're unhappy, if we're sad, if we're mad, if we're angry, if we're frustrated, if we're isolated, if we're alone, if we're afraid, get rid of that stuff in your life and that's your purpose. Get rid of the turbulence. Your idea, your ideal for your life is to be happy. Now that's silly, right? If I was to say you're going to take a flight from Orlando to London today The purpose of that is to get to London. That's the purpose of your trip. And I would imagine for those of you guys that don't take Xanax and you're awake the whole trip, you're going to feel some turbulence between Orlando and London. Now, the purpose of the flight in mid-flight, according to the American culture, is let's just get rid of turbulence. That's not the purpose. The purpose is get to London, and sometimes there's going to be turbulence. Get to London, sometimes there's going to be turbulence, and during the turbulence, learn to trust the pilot. Learn to trust the plane. That's where we're at in this series, okay? So we want to learn today that our purpose in life is not to get rid of the turbulence. Our purpose in life is when turbulence happens or when good things happen, we trust God. We lean into God no matter what. If things are going good, we trust God. If things are going badly, we trust God. But our American mindset, and it's seeped its way into the church, right? Come on. This has seeped its way into the church, is this idea of prosperity where, you know what, a good Christian will have no problems. There won't be any bumpiness, which makes all of us, which is every single one of us, when we do have problems, either question our religion or question our God. Because, hey, this doesn't line up with what I've been told, but I've had problems, and so I've got to disguise those problems so nobody will believe that I'm a hypocrite. Here, let it out at Orlando North. You're going to have problems. As a matter of fact, it's probably going to be a really turbulent flight. And I hate turbulence. And you probably hate turbulence as well. And I wish we could get rid of it, but that's not our purpose. Our purpose is bigger than this. So today, let's look at the life of David in 1 Samuel chapter 24. And we're going to walk through this. We're going to walk through David just, good season, really bad season, where his decisions, his choices, everything that he decided killed hundreds of people. We talked about this last week. Sometimes our decisions don't necessarily directly affect us, but they hurt those around us, and we're so selfish we don't even see that. And so we've got all these people that are impacted by this, and David, his decision, I mean, this is before Bathsheba. We think Bathsheba was his worst decision, or killing Uriah. At least he only killed one person with Uriah, but with these guys, he killed hundreds of people with his decision to take matters into his own hands. And now all of a sudden, in 1 Samuel 24, we have the rebound. And the rebound is a good thing. So let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 24, and I want to read this together. You guys with me still? Yeah? Okay, 1 Samuel chapter 24. I'm going to read the first seven verses. We're going to talk about them, and we're going to apply them to our lives. Starting with verse 1. And this is while Saul is going after David, so he's hunting David down. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all of Israel, and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. Now, it's important to know, when we last left David, how many men did he have with him? Anybody? Zero. Okay, so you were right. Those of you guys that didn't answer, you nailed it. He had zero men with him, okay? Now, all of a sudden, he has 600 men. So 600 men have heard of David's plight and decided to join him as he is running from Saul. So Saul has 3,000 men. David has 600. Quite a difference there. Verse 3. So Saul came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Can I get back to that one in a moment, please? Anybody? We cool? Eighth grade boys? We good? Yeah? We can talk about Saul relieving himself in a cave? Okay, no visuals. We'll just talk about that. Verse. You can underline verse 3. It's really funny stuff. Verse 4. And then the men of David said to him, "Here is the day in which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand.'" So this is his guys saying to him, "David, there he is, take him. You shall do to him as it shall seem good to you." Then David arose and stealthily, wow, this is cool, stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And afterwards, David's heart struck him, because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed." Lowercase Lord. That I should do this to Saul, the Lord's anointed. "To put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Now let's talk about verse 3 for a minute. He's relieving himself in a cave. Let's think about what's going on here. This is incredible. This is incredible stuff. David's on the run, right? He's on the run. Saul is after him. Is Saul after him for a good reason? No, okay? So some of the plight, some of the things, some of the stress in your life, maybe you brought it on yourself. I brought a lot of my stress on myself. Anybody else, or is that just me? Okay? And then there's times when other people have brought the stress on you. This is one of those moments. This is one of those moments for David. David has served King Saul faithfully to the point where Saul allowed him to be best friends with his son. Allowed him to marry his daughter, Michal. Okay, so he's married to his daughter, so he's the king's son-in-law. And through everything, he has served Saul. He's killed Goliath. He's defeated the Philistines. He's killed thousands and thousands of Philistines, all in the name of Saul. And Saul, rather than being a grateful father-in-law or a grateful king, is jealous and angry. He's like, David, I'm coming after you, boy. Watch out, I'm coming after you. And David's like, oh, what did I do? I didn't do anything wrong here. So we see this, and last week we looked at the story where David, while running from King Saul, while he's being attacked, takes matters into his own hands, goes and gets Goliath's sword, takes bread that he wasn't supposed to get, lies to the priest, and all of this ultimately leads to all those people dying. So he's taken matters into his own hands. And at the end, he's like, what have I done? What have I done in this situation? Now we see in chapter 23, leading up to what we've just read, we see David in a different mood, a different attitude, a different atmosphere, if you will. What's going on here in chapter 3 is all of a sudden David receives word while he's running from Saul. He receives words that the Philistines have attacked one of the Israelite cities, Keilah, K-E-I-L-A-H. It's probably pronounced something way more Jewish sounding than what I just did, okay? So use your Hebrew there, and I'll just go Keilah, because I am very Caucasian. So we've got Keilah out there. And so here's Keilah, the city of Keilah, and the Philistines have attacked Keilah. And notice what David does. This is awesome. David doesn't rush into battle in chapter 23. The very first thing David does is he says, hey, Lord, do you want me to go to battle? Woo! Things have changed for David. He is back to asking God, God, what shall I do? Instead of, hey, this is what I should do. This is what seems appropriate. He says, God, what should I do? Now, David's a mighty warrior. David probably could have fought these guys off. But the thing that was going on here is God wasn't just testing David. God was changing David's heart back to being a heart after God. So he's like, hey, God, what should I do? And by the way, step back 10,000 feet, 30,000 feet, and look at this story. By going after the Philistines in Keilah, there we go. We got the Hebrew version. So if he's going to Keilah, what's he doing? He's serving Saul. He's again helping the guy who is attacking him. It's like, hey, Saul, I'll throw you a bone. Even though you're trying to kill me and hunt me down, they're still my people. And I still love them. And I still have a calling on my life. God, what do I do? Can I protect them? Do you want me to protect them? God says, yes, go protect them. And God, David goes and defends the city of Keilah. Now, what happens from there? It's crazy. This is a good thing. Again, David serves the king. David serves the people. And Saul finds out that David has defended the city of Keilah, and he's ticked off. Pretty good king, right? Great king. Like, oh, how dare you rescue my people, you jerk. So he's like, okay, you've rescued my people. I've heard that you're there. I'm going after you. He hunts down David. David runs. David goes to, I've got to make sure I get it right. It starts with an E, the wilderness of En-Gedi. Okay, he runs to the wilderness of En-Gedi. Now, En-Gedi is on the west coast of the Dead Sea. Okay, and what it is, En-Gedi is an interesting wilderness. Because what it is, it's a big mountain at the edge of the Dead Sea that just shoots straight up. It's made out of limestone. And on this limestone mountain are sheep, and there's sheep all over the place. And then there's caves. And in these caves are where people hide. And this is where David is hiding. Now, the people of En-Gedi, they're great people, great folks. So great that when they heard that David was hiding out in their caves, they started text messaging Saul. They're like, hey, we know where David is. You know the guy that's defending you? The guy that's killing all the Philistines? We got him. I bet you they were afraid. They heard what had happened at Nob with the priest. If we don't report that David's here, we're next. Our city's going down. Oh, Saul, David, he's right there. Ever played hide and go seek with a 3-year-old? Right? So he's right there. Or played it with me because I do that too. I'm like, he's right there. Okay, so David's right there. So Saul comes, he's like, all right, Saul and his 3,000 men go after David and his 600, and they're hiding out in caves. How big are these caves that they're hiding this many men? 600 men are hiding in a cave. And all of a sudden, nature calls. Verse 3. Saul's eating too much Chipotle, right? Like, Chipotle is kicking in, and Saul's like, all right, I got to relieve myself. So in verse 3, it says that he goes into the cave. And we know from reading the story who's in the cave. Out of all the caves in this mountain, he picks the cave that David and his men are in. Are you kidding? Now, if this is a movie, the Oscars are tonight, I'm sure they won't be political at all. Right? I'm sure they'll be all about the movies. But if Hollywood was producing this film, if they're producing this movie, the music, I should have talked to JoJo or Chase. We should have gotten some dramatic music going on here. Because here comes Saul. Saul's got to go to the bathroom. He walks in the cave. And in this cave are all these soldiers, including David. And David's eyes are kind of already adjusted. You know how your eyes get after, you know, for those of us above 40, when we do our first bathroom trip of the night, our eyes still haven't adjusted, but the 17th time later, we're like, yeah, I got this without the lights, right? So David is in this boat right now. He's like, okay, I can see what's going on. Saul walks into this cave, and he can't see anything. And he lights up the joint. I mean, he like, I've Can I do my puns? All the women that are about to be offended, just these are puns for all my eighth grade boys that are in here. Melanie, don't be embarrassed. David literally had caught Saul with his pants down. There's that one. He was causing a stink, and Saul currently has no throne to sit on. By the way, the lack of an H in that word is very important. Saul had no throne to sit on. Okay, so here he is. He's going to the bathroom. He's relieving himself. And all this stuff is... And David is right. I'm so sorry. I'm not sorry, but I am. And so David is sitting there. How awkward. I mean, privacy, right? Give this man a break. He's going to the bathroom in front of, at most, 600 people. No big deal. At minimum, one who is about to be king. And he's doing his business. And while he's in there, what do David's guys say to him? David's guys, his trusted guys. Hey, David, you see this? This is your moment. Like, you're anointed. You're called to be king. This guy has taunted you. This guy has hunted you down. Nobody will blame you if you take this dude's life right now. Matter of fact, they start quoting God. They use God as a reference point. They're like, oh, by the way, this is the Lord putting him in your hands. This is God. Take him out. And David's got to be thinking, yeah, I can see how this could play out. If I kill him, I become king immediately. If I kill him, I'm not going to have to run anymore. I'm not going to be chased anymore. If I kill him, this story is over. Brand new, all done. Do you think David might have been thinking back to his last chapter in the gap where he took matters into his own hands and everything unraveled? He's like, oh, last time I took the sword in my own hands. Last time I lied to the priest, last time I did not ask God what he wanted, that ended horribly. And David's like, or the guys are like, come on, David, you can do it. I know you're the guy. This is your moment. This is your season. You can make the turbulence go away. And David's like, but that's not the point. The point isn't making the turbulence go away. The point is God's purpose in this. How can God be glorified? Will God be glorified if I slit the throat of Saul? Now, could David have done it? Yeah. He's a pretty good killer, by the way. He's really good. He's killed a bear. He's killed a lion with his bare hands. He's killed thousands of enemy soldiers. So taking a life was not the deal. It was taking Saul's life without the permission or the blessing of God. And at first, the pride kind of gets... There was temptation there, right, for David? Like, at first, he goes and he cuts off an edge of the cloak of Saul. So he had to get close, right? He tears off a piece of his cloak and why did he do that? Because God told him to? No, he did it because he wanted to prove a point to Saul. And he would later, it would catch his heart. He's like, why did I do that? But he still used it. Saul gets done. Saul leaves. And they have this conversation. David's like, Hey, Saul. It's David. Woo. Saul at that moment's like, David! You know, he's probably mad. He holds up the piece of cloth. Saul, I had you. And by the way, this happens twice. I had you. I could have taken your life. And at that point, you know how Saul responds, right? Oh, David, man, you are a better man than me. You're a good dude. Thank you, buddy. We're good. Come back home, bud. I'm sorry. My bad. Any of you guys have enemies like that? It's like, my bad. And you're like, whatevs. Right? And he's like, no, seriously. And then we know how the story goes. We know exactly how it goes. It goes the same way with Pharaoh and Moses. Yeah, you can go. You can go. Or, hey, yeah, you can come back. Moment later, their hearts harden, and it's like, no, I still hate you. I'm going to go for you. I'm going to get you. David had his opportunity. David had his moment, and he didn't take it. And he's like, hey, Saul, I could have killed you. I could have, but I didn't kill you. And he could have done what he did while he was in the city of Nob. So he cuts it off. God was only testing, as I said this earlier, but God was not only testing David, but he was reestablishing David's heart after himself. Last week, David's heart went towards isolation, fear, and anger, where he was making decisions. And don't we all do this? Like, seriously, last week, I know the lights were off and we're in this deep moment at the end of service, but it's the most response we've ever gotten at Orlando North Church was last week when I said, have any of you guys, are you suffering consequences? Or are people close to you suffering consequences because of decisions you made out of fear, isolation, or anger? Boom, hands everywhere. And then I asked, how many of you guys right now are in the midst of a really critical decision that if you're not careful, you're going to make it because you're isolated and alone, you're afraid, or you're angry? Boom, 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 hands everywhere. This is what happened with David. So David is not only being tested by God when he puts Saul in here, but David is also being worked on by God by saying, I want your heart back. I don't want these decisions of isolation, fear, and anger to control you and manipulate you. I want you to trust me, even when the biggest temptation of your life is sitting in front of you. You see, David, listen, man, David gets so much credit for the battle between David and Goliath. Right? We're talking about it in our Connect groups. All of you, how many of you guys have gone through the fear DVD with Louie in your Connect group already so far this month? Okay? Catch up this side. Come on, man. Everybody over here is like, yeah, where you at? So you got to watch it. It's an incredible chapter. It's an incredible one about fear. And so in this, Louie Giglio is talking about Goliath must fall, and he's talking about fear, rejection, comfort, anger, and addiction, all these different things that we struggle with, these Goliaths in our life. And these are true. These are real. And Goliath was a really big deal to David, but I want to suggest that David's biggest battle in his life was not Goliath. I actually want to suggest that Goliath was probably pretty easy for David. He was so confident in the Lord when he came up there. He's like, you come at me as sword and shield and javelin? Dude, you got nothing. I come against you in the name of the Lord God of hosts, whom you have defiled. You have no chance. David's not cocky. He's confident, not in himself, but in God. He knows what's going on. This was an easy battle. I think the biggest battle of David's life was not against Goliath. I think it was Saul, his father-in-law, the king, the one who should support him, the one who should be with him, the one who should be demonstrating to him what it's like to be a king, showing him the reins, showing him how to be a dad, showing him how to be a husband, showing him how to be all these things. The one who should have been his greatest support was the one who was attacking him. His biggest battle was against him. See, schoolyard bullies, big deal. That is a really big deal. I understand it. But those that are close to you, where there's an emotional whatever going on, there's conflict and anger and spirituality, all this stuff, mental anguish, all of this stuff going on at once, and it just does not go away. David's biggest battle was Saul. So I don't want to ask you today, because this is for your Connect groups, who are your Goliaths? I want to ask you, who are your Sauls? What is your Saul? What is taunting you and harassing you and going after you and will not stop, and it's relentless, 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 and you finally have a way out if you take matters into your own hands and you do it your own way. And you look at God and you go, God, what do I do? And God says, you trust me. I got this. That's hard, right? Especially when the answer's right there and you're saying, I can do this myself. I can take care of this problem right now. And God's like, don't you dare touch the Lord's anointed. How humbling is that? And I don't think it's just because Saul was king. I think it's because Saul was God's plan. So God's saying, don't you dare interrupt my plan. What would have happened if he killed Saul? What would have happened? He would have become king, but he would have become king because he killed the previous king. So in that, two things, two quick things, and then I'm done. Two things that, what's the big word? It's a really big word that it starts with an I. Illusions. Yeah, big words. I went to school for that. Two great illusions in our life. Two great illusions in our life. Number one is the illusion of reputation. Without me even saying a word and describing this, how many of you guys would say, yep, I'm there. I'm worried about what other people think about me. The illusion of reputation. What was David's reputation at this moment? Well, a lot of people really liked him. A lot of people really loved him. People were singing his praises. Saul has killed 1,000, but David has killed his tens of thousands. So David was kind of a big deal. And he probably knew it. Even if he was trying to be humble, he still knew he was a big deal. He kind of got that. But I want you to think about something. David's on the run. In the last chapter of his gap life, he had nobody with him. He was all alone, isolated. Now all of a sudden there's 600 men with him. Where did those 600 men come from? They came from their love for David. They knew what was going on with Saul. They knew what was going on back home. And listen, they left everything. They left their wives. They left their home. They left the comfort of everything they knew to come serve David, to come protect David. And all of a sudden, think about this. All of a sudden, the opportunity to fulfill what they thought was God's plan, which was to kill David. They thought the mission was to kill Saul. They thought this was the mission, protect David, kill Saul. All of a sudden, the opportunity is there. And they're like, David, do this. You were called for this moment. Do it. Light this dude up, man. He's vulnerable, like literally as vulnerable as he can ever be. Take him out. And do you think for one moment, David was thinking, well, forget about me for a minute. If I take him out, not only do I become king, but my boys get to go home. 600 men that are following him and have left everything get to go home to their wives and their kids and their houses. Oh, and by the way, once they left home to serve David, what did they become at home? They became outlaws. So they can't go home unless David kills Saul. And so they're like, hey, David, could you do us a solid here, man? Can you take out Saul so I can see my honey? I haven't seen my kids in a while. We could really use some matzo ball soup right about now. Like, hook a brother up. And David's like, I won't touch the Lord's anointed. His reputation was at stake. Do you think for a minute David's worried that these guys are going to think he's a coward? Even though he's killed people, he's done all this. But David could be, what about me? What are they going to think? And God's like, you know what? I'm not really concerned with what people think about you. I'm concerned about my mission. Will you be faithful to my mission no matter what it costs you? Oh, God would never do that. You didn't listen when I read Philippians 2, you crazy people. Listen to what Jesus did. Thousands of years later, remember when they're in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Judas is about to come betray Jesus. The cross is right around the corner. All this stuff is about to happen. And the soldiers show up. And what does Peter do? My boy Peter. Man, I love Peter. What does Peter do? Pull out a sword, cuts a dude's ear off, right? He's like, no. I'm going to protect Jesus with a sword. What a slice, man. Be able to hit an ear. He was probably trying to hit his whole head, and he just missed and hit his ear. He takes the dude's ear off. What does Jesus say? Matthew 26. Jesus said to Peter, put your sword back in its place. For all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? David, like Jesus, knew that more was at stake than just his reputation. Did Jesus get a bad reputation from the people around? Did he deserve that reputation? He didn't. But Jesus is like, we're on mission. We're not here to fix turbulence. We're here to finish the purpose. So it wasn't about his reputation at all. The second illusion is the illusion of revenge. Would you agree that our world is pretty angry right now? Yeah. Wherever you look, culture is mad. And some of it's justified, right? Some of it's justified, and it's angry. Now, listen, this is really important. This can make me sound old. Millennials, forgive me, but I do believe social media plays into this big time. Because now it lends a voice to everybody, which is good. We should all have a voice. But instead of having conversations, we are defending our position at all costs and just yelling and yelling and yelling. It's just getting angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier, where everything in our life is about revenge. I need to prove that I'm right. I need to protect my reputation, and I need to exact revenge. And this is what David's guys were telling David to do. Do you know what he's done to you? David, you're hiding because of this guy. You're hiding because he's going after you. You have served him. Not only have you done nothing wrong to him, you have served this dude. Go after him. Get him. Seek your revenge. Do it. Go after him. But David saw something that they couldn't see, because David was seeking God's face. And he saw the Lord's anointing. He saw the Lord's purpose. He's like, I will not touch this dude. I wrote down, I think it's in your notes, and this is us as Christ followers. We need to hear this. We have an absolute mandate to see past the surface level of people who are hurting and people who have hurt us. We have the mandate to see that those who are hurting people hurt people. If you are being hurt, there's a really good chance that the person hurting you is also hurting. In our resolution, because we're strong and we're tough and we're violent and we're men and we're women, we're like, no, they hurt me, I hurt them back. No, as a Christ follower, you need to see, why are they hurting me? They are probably hurting. How can I reconcile? How can I make things right? There's this illusion, there's this idea of reputation and revenge that this is the godly way. And David says, this is not God's way. This is not God's way. Those who are hurting people are hurting people. What do we do with that? The illusion of revenge, the illusion of reputation. This week, I'm about to wrap up. This week, this was not part of the sermon until late last night. And I don't have all the names. This week, I had breakfast with a longtime friend of mine, Mark McCartney. He's a missions pastor in Texas at a big church, really large church in Texas. His dad is Bill McCartney, Many of you guys know who Bill McCartney is. Bill McCartney was the head football coach at Colorado University that beat Notre Dame for a national championship way back in the day. So those of you guys that hate Notre Dame, you now love Bill McCartney, okay? So go Bill. He was on staff with Bo Schembechler at Michigan. And if you don't know sports, he started Promise Keepers. So he's the guy who started the men's movement of Promise Keepers. His son, Mark. Oh, and then if you don't know him, he had an ESPN 30 for 30 last year. So there's all of that stuff. And Mark, his son, I met when I was at Calvary as a young adult pastor, and he brought his conference to us, and we talked and we became friends. Mark is the one who got us the Louis Giglio video last year for our anniversary. So this is who I was talking to, and I trust him. I trust him deeply. This man loves Jesus. And we were talking. We're just talking through life, and we're talking about struggles, talking about good things, talking about just everything. We sat at the Mall of Millennia food court for 2 hours. He did most of the talking, believe it or not. He did most of the talking. And so we're out there and you're talking and he's hearing what's going on with me. He's like, Rob, my pastor, who's been there for 38 years, preached a sermon about self-leadership, about leading yourself. Before you can lead others, you need to lead yourself. And you need to be a good leader of yourself. You need to be a biblical leader of yourself. He said, I want you to watch this video. And he explained it to me at the Mall of Millennials. So once I heard it, and then I listened to it and watched the video twice, once by myself and once with Melanie. I've shared it with Chase. I've shared it with my buddy Grunt. And in this video, he bases this off a secular book, but he turns it into a Christian thing. He says, in our lives, we have seasons. And I think as Christians, we forget that. We're so focused on the tree in front of us that we don't do the 30,000-foot view and see that God works in seasons. God works in seasons. And there's basically four seasons of your ministry. There's four seasons of your marriage. There's four seasons of your walk with the Lord. And typically, it starts with the dreaming stage or the dreaming season where everything's great. It's just glorious. You fall in love with a girl and you're like, man, I can't wait to get married. You're dreaming about getting married, maybe having kids, making a life with them. This is what we're going to do. This is where we're going to live. We got dreams, right? Or you're a Christian. You remember when you first became a Christian and you loved this thing so much and you couldn't be involved enough. You couldn't serve enough. You couldn't be in the house of the Lord enough. You were Bobby at all times, man. Okay, so you remember those days, the dream days? Or in your ministry or your career, you had all these dreams. This is what I want to do. This is what I can't wait to see this happen. Maybe your business, your church, you have all these dreams. Dreaming stage is fun. Man, if we could live in the dream, whoo, life would be cake. He says, but then we go from the dream stage to this season of doing, where we take our dreams and we start making them happen. So we get married, we have kids, we buy the house. So we start serving in Guts or in Go Youth Group or being a greeter or preaching or playing the piano or dressing like exactly like JoJo when you're on stage. We start you did catch that, right? Chase and JoJo look exactly the same today. And so we start doing. Or you plant a church and you have all these dreams. And so you make those happen. You try to find a facility. 11 years later, you're still looking for that facility. And you're telling people to come to church. And you're coming with a sermon. You're just doing. You're making these things happen. If we could live there, awesome. But the third phase, the third phase is the drag. And they have to start with D because we're pastors and everything starts. It's an alliteration. So you got the dream, you got the do, you got the drag. And this pastor says the drag typically happens about every 5 to 7 years. So the drag, people look at it and it's like this time of frustration. It's time like, man, everything, it's not working. It's not working the way it wants to. I mean, on the outside, everybody, it's like, it's cool, it's good. But you know, on the inside, it's just not in balance. Something is shaky. Something's not working perfectly. Just something's out of line. It's not terribly wrong, but something, it's time to go into the shop and get something corrected. It's not the end of the road. It's just, this is tough. Something's not right. Do you know what we do when we get to the drag? I was ahead of him. He's preaching. I'm like, I know what we do when we get to the drag. We go back to doing. And we try everything that we've done before. And we say, if I keep doing it, because these were my dreams once upon a time, and if I keep doing it, it's going to fix itself and it's going to work itself out of the drag. And we keep doing, and we keep doing what we've always done. And what happens? We're like, I haven't left the drag. I am still in this stinking drag. Get me out of this drag. So in our Christian walk, we're like, why can I not get my prayers through? Why can God not hear me? Marriages fall apart because in the drag, husbands get bored. They're like, well, you know what? What I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and I'm going to have the exact same dreams and I'm going to have the exact same doing. I'm just going to choose a different partner. And nothing changes. You're still in the drag. Now, the important step is not necessarily drag. You got to understand, number one, the drag is God's season. It's not Satan's season. This is a good season. It's just tough. This is where God starts working on our hearts, saying, hey, man, I need to do something in your heart. I want to give you new dreams. And when you get new dreams, you're going to be able to do new things. I don't want you to keep recycling the old stuff. I don't want you to try to fix things the way you've always fixed them. This is where David went wrong in the drag. He said, okay, God's not coming through. Let me go get Goliath's sword. Let me lie to the priest. And how did that work out for him? In order to get new dreams and go back to that season of dreaming and doing, we got to go to the fourth stage, which is the dark stage. Now, dark, that sounds bad, but it had to start with D. But dark, here's what it means. It's the cocoon stage. It's where I get alone with God. I get away from all the noise. I get away from all the clutter. I let godly men and women counsel me, but then I go into the dark and I say, God, what do you have to tell me? Is there sin in my life? Or are you just done with this season? What's going on in this drag where you got to do, and we can't hear his voice unless we go dark. Because we're going a million miles an hour everywhere. We're like, God, talk to me, talk to me. He's like, I've got no space to talk to you. Go dark. Let me talk to you, and when I do, I will give you brand new dreams. And then when I give you, and that doesn't mean going to a new place. It's like, I am going to give you brand new dreams, and you're going to be excited and passionate. Still going to be turbulent, but in that, you're going to have passion. This is what David did in the gap. Where he's like, okay, it didn't work out for me when I kept going back, rewind, doing the same old things. Like, let me go to God. God, what do you want me to do? You don't want me to touch Saul? Okay. I won't touch Saul. I will be faithful. I will keep fighting the way you tell me to. I will keep serving the way you tell me to. And one day the promise is fulfilled and he sits on the throne. He has brand new dreams. How many of you guys, listen, how many of you guys right now say, I get the drag. Like, I am dead center in the middle of the drag. I think this morning God wants to do something here. Something really, really important. Until you go dark, you are going to be stuck spinning your wheels on the drag, trying to figure it out. At some point, you got to surrender to God, and it's not just for 5 minutes on a Sunday morning. It's getting out of here and going, okay, I am setting aside time, like significant time, where I am going to hear God. God, what do you have for me? Not what do you want me to do? Like, what is your vision for me? What is your dream for my family? What is your dream for my marriage? What is your dream for my work? What is your dream? What do you have? And it's not running from something. It's running to what God has for you next. And I tell you, I'll tell you, when you do that, he answers. But you got to go dark. David was successful in this moment because he finally relented and said, God, what do you want? Not what do I want. What do you want? Let me finish with these questions. Glenn, you can go ahead and flip the lights because I'm going to pray for some folks in a second. Answer these inwardly and honestly. Are there areas in your life that you're protecting your reputation at all costs? The most important thing to you is what other people think. Does your reputation trump the plans God has for your life? If you were given right now a clean way to exact revenge on your enemy, would you take it? Please note, exacting revenge, this is important. If you exact revenge, if you choose this mode, I promise you that makes you the perpetual victim. It is not eternally rewarding, and it always puts you in a place where the one who has harmed you continues to own you. Are you willing to forfeit God's plan for your life to exact revenge on someone who is hurting you? Are you willing to forfeit God's plan for your life for your reputation? Are you able to look past the hurt your enemy is causing you and see that there's something much deeper going on in them? Remember, hurting people are hurting people. Are you willing to be like Jesus and allow God to take care of those who hurt you and work in them? And are you mature enough to pray that God will do something beautiful in their heart rather than destroy them? Are you willing to take the first step in reconciliation, even if it doesn't work? By the way, what David did when he was done with the cave and he had Saul's cloth in his hand, he doesn't come out. It's interesting. He doesn't come out and say, "Oh, Saul," in the passive-aggressive approach where you sandwich the stab with comfort. He didn't come out and say, "Oh, Saul, you know what? Maybe I've hurt you, man. I don't know." No, he's like, no, there's no political correctness here. He's like, no, Saul, you have wronged me. And we need to talk. But David's pursuit here was reconciliation. I could have killed you. I don't want that. Saul, I don't want your throne until God's done with you on the throne. This is God's throne, not mine. And he pursued reconciliation, not revenge. Bow your heads, please. This morning we're going to be a little bit braver. Elders, if you'll join me up here, please, and your wives. This morning, your reputation and your idea of revenge is controlling you. It's controlling you. And you know it, and your heart is racing out of your chest right now. This is not a bad thing. This is not God's condemnation on you. This is not God punching you in the back of the head saying, "Suck it up, buttercup." This is God saying, "I love you so much that I want to speak through this. I want to use this in your life right now. I want to get you from this drag to a dark place alone with me so that you can dream again. I don't want this controlling you." So if that's you, here's what I want you to do first. Be brave, please. This is you and God. This is real business here. If any of those questions, you're like, "My reputation or revenge, those have a place in my heart right now." And believe me, we've all been there or are there. If that's you, just stand right where you're at right now. Don't wait for everybody else to do it. Thank you. Don't be scared of these elders down here. I know some of you guys aren't standing because you're afraid of what's next. God wants to do something in your heart. If you're standing, if you should be standing, will you just come on up in front of one of the elders and let them and their spouse just pray with you for a minute? And I'm going to pray over the whole congregation while this happens. I want to break through here for you this morning. Heavenly Father, in Jesus' name we come to you because you're gracious and you're good. And we want to trust you today. Somewhere along the lines, we bought into this lie that Satan has told us, this illusion, that our reputation is what matters most. That getting balance and getting things right, making things right in our own hands is what matters. You've taught us to turn the other cheek. You've taught us to love our brothers in truth and in love. This doesn't mean we don't speak truth. God, your heart is to make things whole and to make things right. I pray for everyone under the sound of my voice today that if, God, we're wrestling with this, if we're struggling with this, if we believe the lies, that the only thing that matters is our reputation, I pray that you would heal us and forgive us. Lead us to truth. Sanctify our minds. Let us remember what this is all about. I pray for us that we wouldn't get caught up in this idea of making life easy. We will stick to your purpose and draw closer to you in the tough seasons and in the good seasons. And that you would teach us something about yourself because you are faithful when we are not. God, restore what's been stolen. Heal what's been broken. And may your will ultimately be accomplished. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
If you're not already a part of Orlando North, please know that we'd love to have you come visit us on Sunday morning at 10:30 for our weekly worship service. We're located at 1021 Douglas Avenue in Altamont Springs, Florida. Come as you are and be welcomed by a church that is eager to connect with you. For more information about our church, you can check us out on the web at orlandonorth.com.